I'm Jerry. I'm a sick alcoholic.
Jerry!
Literally, I got a cold, so you hug at your own risk, okay? Yesterday, I called Susan. I said, I really don't think I'm going to make it, you know, and I felt like I was on my deathbed, and she wouldn't accept it. No, I'll come and get you. I remember I called in to work sick one time, and they actually did that. They showed up at my door and brought me on in to work. You know, I was like, I don't know what that's about. But I read a scripture talking about wings of eagles, and you will not tire, and all that. I can't remember word for word. And I got up and said, I will not tire, and then I fell right back into bed. I said, send me another eagle, God. That one is done. But, you know, my sobriety dates, October 29th, 1991. I do not recommend checking into treatment a few days before Halloween. What they'll do is, like, dress up in costumes, and you can't tell if that's real or not. You know? They let me out of detox, and I'm looking behind me, and there's the devil back here. You know, I'm like, oh, my God, I've gone too far. Then I see a bumblebee go across. I thought, oh, my God, I'm hallucinating. And when I got to the cafeteria, it had all the Halloween stuff. I was like, whew, thank God. And I went to them. I said, look, y'all should not dress up on Halloween. You have to consider who's in this building, you know. So, you know, I grew up in a violent alcoholic home. And the miracle of that is that I didn't die and I didn't kill anybody. You know, I was going to start off because one of the things that I do, I ask whenever I listen to a fifth step, I've listened to about 300 of them, is what is it you don't want to tell me? What's your secret? You know, and my secret is that I'm autistic. I don't like to tell that because people don't understand it and it really confuses them. And I get peppered with questions and trying to explain it is very difficult. The best thing I could tell you is that I have a very high IQ but a very low EQ. You know, I don't have a social instinct. I'm socially dyslexic. And that's why on my report card, they were like, it isn't that he doesn't play well with others. He doesn't play with others at all. I just sit by myself, you know. I couldn't see a reason to go play with you. And even today, I talked to my therapist, and she's trying to encourage me to make friends. I'm like, what really is in it for me? You know, because I've really not, like, benefited from that. I mean, Sue's my friend. That's my best friend. It's sort of like, you ever watch Tombstone? And they ask Doc Holliday, what are you doing out here, Doc? You should be in the bed somewhere. He like, why I'd hurt my friend? Well, hell, I got plenty of friends. Doc Holliday said, I don't. You know? I don't. That's it right there. No, I have people who really like me. And one of the things I didn't understand for a long time, what was wrong with me, even in recovery, I still felt odd, left out. You know, my sponsor would work, they said, I don't know what's going on with you. And it wasn't until 2012, Christmas Day, that I gave a lead. And now when I went to treatment, they diagnosed me or psychoanalyzed me, right? They gave me this MMPI. And it wasn't pretty. They said I was a master manipulator who would con people out of their money, and they would thank him for taking it. I'm like, I've never done that. And then 2 years later, I'm making amends to my girlfriend for borrowing some money to pay a drug debt. And she said, you know, I'm just glad I was able to be there to give it to you. I'm like, oh, my God. Total lack of self-awareness here. And the scary part was, they said, he's a virtual sociopath who could kill or maim someone and feel absolutely no guilt or remorse about it whatsoever. And dude, as he said, is this true? He's saying this in front of the group, okay? And I said, okay, keep in mind, I haven't done this. There are no bodies. But whereas other people wonder if they could kill, I just wonder when and what the circumstances are going to be. See, because that's what the drugs and alcohol prevented. You know, I had tried on several occasions to kill family members. You know, I go into this rage. Me and my sponsor, when we did my first fifth step, well, it wasn't the first fifth step, more like the second or the third. But I went over my fear list. It's about 5 pages. The first one, I was focused on resentment. You know, about 5 pages of resentments. But the fear list was about a half a page. Because, you know, I'm so pissed, I ain't afraid of nothing. Then the resentment list was about a half a page. Was like 5 pages of fear. And I get halfway through. He said, stop. Is there anything you're not afraid of? I said, no, to be honest, I'm afraid of everything. You know. Growing up in that home, it wasn't fear, it was terror. My response wasn't anger, it was rage. And that's where trying to kill somebody came in. When I was 14, it's the only time I went to jail, or even came close to it. I didn't go to jail. They just took me into the jail, but they put me on bars, you know. And police lady down the street said, you've got the wrong one. He's the nice one. Let us tell you about Mr. Nice Guy and what he did, you know. And they detailed my activities, my morning activities, and it took 5 policemen to take me out. Now, you got to keep in mind, I don't know how little I was, but when I graduated high school, I was 5'4", 75 pounds. So at age 14, I wasn't very big at all, but it took 5 of them to take me out. That's when I thought, Hulk smash, okay? Hulk smash. And my father, she asked me, who you want me to contact, your mother or your father? I'm like, ooh, what a choice. Mama, it'd take her a week to get down here. Daddy gonna beat my ass. Because I have broken out every window in the house. I've cut my sister and just went teetotally off. And they had him come and get me. And recently I thought about what kind of conversation I might have had with him. You know. But it scared him so much that he didn't know how to talk to me. Matter of fact, he didn't say a word to me. We drove home in silence. I'm waiting on it, but he didn't say a word. And just when I get out the car, he says, wait a minute. He said, boy, you got this temper, and one day it's going to get you into some trouble. I won't be able to get you out of. You better deal with it. And that's how I was raised. You know, you deal with it. You know, you deal with it. Dad was like providing. Mama was drinking, the alcoholic mother. And that's when Star Trek came on, and the Vulcans sounded a whole lot like me. You know, their anger and rage was going to destroy their planet and them, and then they relied on logic and reason. So I became Spock, you know. Made sense to me. I mean, that was my nickname growing up, was Spock. I ain't got big ears. I just relied on reason and logic, and I stuffed the emotional part. And I did so well that by the time I got to treatment, they diagnosed me as a sociopath, a dangerous one. You know, it was kind of funny. The guy sitting next to me, Red, I still remember him. First time I met him, he was telling me how crazy he was. You know? And then when they read my diagnosis, Red moved. Red, like, oh, my God. This is the real deal right here. You know, but I was like supposed to be peer group leader. I turned it down because I'm like, I just need to be a part of. I don't need to be up here. I need to be just a part of. And we used to have group in my meeting, in my room, meeting after the meeting. Them guys are locking their doors, you know. So that was a misdiagnosis. And I went a long time misdiagnosed. But it explained to me, why drugs and alcohol work so well for me. You know, I could socialize when I drink, you know. And I had a very weird reaction to marijuana. I didn't get goofy. I got intellectual. I start reading books, you know, and my partner would be like, if you're going to say something to Jerry, say it now because he just picked up that book and you won't be able to talk to him. Oh, he's gone. So, you know, I thought about the first time I drank, you know, and I was 8 years old growing up in an alcoholic home, and my sister came home from a failed marriage, filled the fridge with beer. I think there's a connection here, failed marriage, filled the fridge with beer. And we just look at it like this nasty pop, you know. We take it down the basement, we shooting, squirting it, just having fun with it. And we're like, oh, we smell like beer. Let's go down to the creek, play in the creek. That's our cover. We're at the creek all day. See, smell us, you know. And my brother start walking towards the creek, and I walk slower and slower and slower. And when they turn in the woods, I run back home and get some more of that nasty pop. I believe that was my first blackout because I don't remember anything after that. But what I learned was I had the phenomenon of craving right away. You know, I drank like an alcoholic from day one. I went to get help for stress one time. I was stressing out, man. And she's like, why do you think you're stressing out? I said, well, I'm drinking a lot more. She's like, well, how much are you drinking? I said, like a case of beer a night. She's like, wow, what do you normally drink? Normally just a 12-pack. That's when the AA literature start flying across the table, right? I said, whoa, what's this? What's this? She said, we're not even going to be able to touch that stress problem until we deal with your drinking problem. Now, I didn't say I had a drinking problem. I just wanted to get back down to my 12-pack a day, you know? I don't know why she said it was a problem. And if she hadn't been so cute, I wouldn't have kept going. Because I was sure, after this, me and her is dating, right? And well, she loaned me her 24-hour day book, which let me know she's in the program, right? And I go home and read this, and I was like, you know, structure's all wrong. The prose is good, but I'm reading it because I'm a writer, you know? And I'm like, there's no plot. Then I start noticing the day. Maybe you're supposed to read this one day at a time, you know? But I read the whole damn book, you know? But what I noted about it, talked about God in a way I never heard God talked about, you know? My introduction to God was like, okay, when I was five, we moved into our house. And I could always read. No one taught me to read. And there was some Bible storybooks, and I spent the whole summer reading them at age five. So the family thinks, wow, you know, he's going to be a minister. I don't know where they get that crap from, you know. But I had a spiritual experience behind that as a five-year-old. I still remember it. Going up to heaven, seeing all the angels and stuff, meeting Jesus, all this. And I was like, if there had been anything else in the house, I would have read that. If War and Peace was in the house, I would have read that. I just read, okay? Later on, I went on to read Playboy, Penthouse, and Hustler, you know? That defined my character more than the Bible did, okay? So that was my introduction. Then it's a drunk mother screaming from the bottom of the stairs. Your daddy's the devil. You just like him. You're going to hell, fire and brimstone, you know? You don't develop a good relationship with God when your mother tells you that, you know, you're going to hell. So it's like, at age nine, I officially became agnostic. We're watching the Ten Commandments and God parts the Red Sea for the Israelites. And I turned to Mama, I'm blown away. You know, Sister DeMille, whatever dude, now he's great. Why did God stop doing miracles, Mama? She's like, I don't know. You know, so I always had questions I would ask people who's supposed to know. And they never had an answer. You know, the best I got was, you just take it on faith. I'm like, oh, you don't know either, huh? I'm just a little kid saying crap like that because I read that. Hey, why ain't God doing this no more? Why ain't God doing that no more? So I read this, and it's talking about we still live in the age of miracles. You know, when I was nine, we needed a miracle. There's no food in the fridge. We so poor, we can't afford the O and the R at the end. We poor, you know. We need a miracle. Where you at, God? You know, I'd like open the fridge. Where's that miracle? Hey, seven loaves. Come on. Feed us, you know. It ain't happening. You know, and I determined at that point, I'm on my own. You know, I'm on my own. And I developed a skill for picking locks. I don't know how that happened. I just told, we watch I Spy, I told my brothers, I can pick locks. They're like, really? Yeah. Come on. They took me down to this house and said, pick that lock. Give me a screwdriver. Give me a bobby pin. Oh, my God, it works, you know. So we break in everybody's house, you know. We just became a bunch of vandals, you know. We break into your house and eat your food, you know. I feel bad because one time it was the top layer of the wedding cake. I ain't know nothing, but there's some cake on top of that fridge. Get it. You know, later on as I grew up, I was like, oh, man. So, you know, we were some scallions, we were some ruffians, and then it's like we discovered fire, and we became arsonists, you know. What we basically were a bunch of dry drunks. From that day we drank, we activated our alcoholism. We couldn't drink anymore, so we raised hell, you know. And it's amazing. Once we all got old enough to drink, most of the criminal activity stopped. I had some brothers who were really deep into it. But it's like we had what we wanted. What I say, we're restless, irritable, discontented, unless we can again experience a sense of ease and comfort that comes at once by taking a few drinks. Now, when you're 8 and 9 or 10 or 11, you're restless, irritable, discontented, crap gets stolen. Crap gets burned up, people get beat up, all kinds of things happen. So that was like the atmosphere I grew up in. I define it in my Al-Anon group that you had like 12 gas cans sitting around waiting on somebody to throw the match. And then it's on, you know. So I left home when I was 18. See, I don't understand this living in mom and dad's basement crap. Daddy had a countdown calendar. You're 18, boy, here, this day. You need to be thinking about that because you out, you know. So, heck, I was 17, man, and I had a job. And my mother wanted all of the paycheck. And I'm like, no, you know, I gave you 15. I put 15 in the bank. I kept 15 to get back and forth to work, you know, responsible. No, she wanted all hell broke loose and took me up to the juvie to lock me away. You know, now remember what I said about 5'4", 75 pounds, right? So I go in there and God think he's dealing with a 10-year-old. And I'm listening to him and he said some very nasty things to me. And I'm waiting on mama to slap him in the mouth because she do not let anybody talk to her kids like that. She may be a drunk, but she protect us. And it dawned on me, oh, my God, she's in on it. You're going to be, and this is when my addiction kicked in. They said, dude, say something or you're going to be in here because I didn't talk at that time, you know. And I told the guy, I said, look, I'm 17. I'll be 18 in 9 months. You won't get me in here. I'll have my father contest custody. She don't want me. I'll go live with him. And he looked at me and looked at her and said, is he telling the truth? She said, yeah. So he looks out the window, turns around, and he's Mr. Good Cop. Son, what's going on? And I tell him everything. You know, the alcoholic family secrets, they're all out in the open. My family often said, we liked you better when you didn't talk. Now, I thought they meant when I went to school, I couldn't talk. They thought I was retarded till they put a piece of paper and a pencil in front of me, and I'm doing mathematical tables, multiplication, division, I'm writing. Like, whoa, you know, you got a little genius on our hands. So I spent half the day in the principal's office with a dictionary with him, teaching me how to talk. And then I go into the class, talk about feeling odd and separate. You know, you walk in, everybody look at you. And then I'm teacher's pet sitting up front. So I thought they always meant that, but they meant that day when I went up to the juvie and told the counselor everything that was going on at home. My father's last dying wish to me was that I leave AA. You know, when I was 2 years sober, I went through a lot of depression in my recovery, and that year was really bad. I didn't get out of bed on Christmas Day till like 5 o'clock, and I went out to the gift shop at the treatment center to work out there, you know, get out of myself. And while I'm done wrapping up, I said, hey, I'll buy some Christmas presents, take them to the Christmas dinner. So some people got big books for Christmas. Don't do it. Don't go there. I'm telling you, do not do it. And at least my father did read it, you know. But it's one thing for a normal person to read it, and another thing for an alcoholic to read it. And that's when he determined that I needed to leave AA. He said, I want you to get married, have kids, give me some grandbaby. I'll leave everything to you, my whole estate. It's like $250,000. He's a hardworking dude, you know. And I told him, I said, look, Daddy, I said, I love you. You've always been my hero. But I can't do that. I said, I'm where God wants me to be, you know. He passed away about a month after that. That was our last conversation, you know. So I called my sponsor and talked about that. And he said, how do you feel? I said, well, if he'd asked me 1,000 times, the answer would be the same way, you know. I'm putting nothing in front of my recovery. When I got out of treatment, my girl lost my token they gave us. You can be a value to no one until you're a value to yourself. And she loses the token from the treatment center home. I mean, how'd you do that? We ain't even got out there. What do you mean you lost the token? You know, and we're going in the house, and I'm like, she's got to go after we have sex. I've been locked up for 30 days. I ain't a fool. So I gave her the stay out of relationships for a year. I said, realistically, 30 days ago, I didn't know I was an addict. You know, if I don't know who I am, how do I know what I want? I did not know how much sense I was making at that time. I was just trying to get her out of the house. You know, but that was the truth. It's what I call relationship roulette. I see that screw a lot of people up, you know. And I'm currently dealing with a situation with a couple of women I sponsor, and they got into the relationship roulette game. One of them 7.5 years sober. And at 5 years, she started dating and lost her freaking mind. You know, she ain't got time to work with newcomers. Got to get her a man. Except she get these great guys. Boy, she really wants that sick addict down there. That's my guy right there. You know, doctor, engineer, business owner, that guy. And that guy was a newcomer, you know, IV user, very high-risk HIV guy. And she didn't like me pointing that out and fired me again, you know. She fires me quite often. And then I got the girl she should be sponsoring, but she ain't got time, and trying to help her. Now, I found out a couple of things doing this about sponsorship. There's different kind of sponsorships, and we need the right one. There's the friendship sponsor, the one who's your friend. And that love between you and them, boom, that solidifies it for you. Then there's the life coach sponsor, you know, the one that helps you through those difficulties. And then there's the step sponsor, one to just freaking take you through the steps. I gotta tell Isaac, I'm a step sponsor. Why? I can't do the first two. Social dyslexia. No social instinct. I don't play with others. So that prevents what I can do with you but I know there's one who has all power, and that's your sponsor. Guess what? My current sponsor who treats me like that, I talk to him once or twice a year. Turned out he's autistic too. You have any clue? You know? But that guy, he took me through the steps. He said, I'm going to take you through the steps the way Dr. Bob did. And that's where I got that I will introduce you to your real sponsor and you work it out in step 11. So I'm working with this girl, but she needs the friend. She needs the life coach. I'm giving her everything I got. And I said, you know, I feel totally inadequate in this situation. Not that I haven't sponsored women. I've sponsored several women. But the question is, do you want to go through the steps? Okay, if you want to go through the steps, I'll take you through the steps, and that's all I do with you. I don't think about childbirth or PMS or anything like that, you know, but I know about the steps. Do you want to go through the steps? So I'm sort of the sponsor of last resort. When they try the first two and it don't work, they're like, damn, I got to have Jerry for a sponsor, you know. So, yeah, that's who I get. And it's been an interesting lot. Murderers, gangbangers, and of late, guys who would be put before the criminal court in Hague, you know, war criminals. But the thing is, we read that anonymity. I let them know that your take of the grave secrets become my take of the grave secrets once you tell me. You got to unload that, and it goes to the grave with me. You know, so this girl, she, it just didn't feel right. And we started fifth step, and she balked. And it reminded me of Eric, this guy I sponsored, who was ready to do his fifth step and balked. And went out that night and OD'd and died. You know, she balked. And a few days later, she calling me from the hotel room, and she needs help, and I know she's dying. She's dying. I said, I can't leave. I'm at work. I get off work at 6. And she's dying. I know she's dying. And my sponsor who fired me, who should have been her sponsor, was too busy dating. I called her. I said, would you help an alcoholic who's dying in a hotel room? Yeah, I'll do that. And she goes there, and yeah, I took her to the hospital. She was dying. And they've been like that since. That's the sponsor she needed. But she's too busy dating. And then, through all of that, she accepted me back, and she told me, I'm through dating. These women need me. I was like, thank God. You know, now the sad thing is, the one that was in the hotel room don't know what went on, but she knows some guys came up in there, and she slept with them. And when one guy that's blowing your phone up is HIV positive, this cannot be good. Okay? See, we got to be aware of that. You know, if there's an opioid crisis, there's probably an HIV crisis coming behind it. I got another sponsee that's HIV positive. You know, I remember in 94, the first CA World Convention I went to, and they had a sex and sobriety workshop, so I'm thinking they're going to show me some Kama Sutra moves. I'm going in here to learn, you know? Yes. That ain't what it was about. But I remember what this guy said. He said, we have to be careful because we are the high-risk category for that. And you need to take care of yourself because I might need you later on. And you're not here because you didn't take care of yourself, you know. And that's why I say relationship roulette. Really exciting love affair turns into outrageous nightmare. Sobriety hangs in peril. I've seen it happen so many times. I'm like, look at page 69. And I always tell them, if you got a hankering for that guy, that gal in the rooms here, well, that's just smoke from a fire that needs to be addressed in Al-Anon. That's how I got there. Been there 25 years. Met a cutie pie in the rooms. Man, that's sweet. I mean, yeah. Then I tell my sponsor, he's like, Al-Anon. Dude, what's up with that? He said, here are four things I want you to do, Jerry. I want you to do a sex inventory. I want you to read Melody Beatty, Codependent No More. I want you to go to Al-Anon, and I don't want you to sleep with her for a year. Can you do that? Man, it's all spiritual. It's all spiritual. I got this. So we do the fifth step, and we're all done. I'm like, there's one more name I need to add to that. He's like, damn it, Jerry. It wasn't all spiritual. So, you know, I ended up in Al-Anon, and you see, what was funny was my therapist was saying it. Random people in the rooms were saying it. My therapist was like, I was so bad that she was going to pay for me to go to a treatment center for codependency. I'm like, what? They got that? Yes, they have that. And she was going to pay, you know, but I turned it down. So I did the six meetings, and at meeting number six, I'm like, cool. I can get up out of here. Till I went, it didn't work. And so they were talking about guilt, and I said, well, I don't know about you, but I feel more guilt about things I didn't do than anything I ever did. And they're like, yeah. I knew what that head nod meant. I belonged in there. You know, I had a friend introduce me one time. He said, Jerry is a friend to all fellowships. What he meant was, Jerry's one sick puppy. And he was right, you know. And all of the mind-altering substances. And I sponsor gambling addicts, sex addicts, crackheads, meth heads. I don't talk to them about what the hell they use. You know, what you got is a spiritual malady. You ain't comfortable in your own skin, and that provides you the comfort, be it gambling, sex, food. I got a 600-pound brother. He's an alcoholic. Stop drinking. Start eating. This year, he decided to make his funeral arrangements. You know? So this disease, cunning, baffling, and powerful, why are we addressing the symptom? Why are we addressing the symptom? It doesn't matter if it's cocaine or if it's alcohol or if it's meth or if it's heroin. What's the underlying problem is that spiritual malady, that dis-ease with God. You know, Carl Jung said it, that when alcoholics drink, they have a low-level spiritual experience, ecstatic union with God. What that means is alcohol becomes our God. You know, we're practicing idolatry. And what I found out about idolatry, and I mean, wow, it hit home. Because I thought there was something just the ancients did, but you need to read some Emmett Fox, okay? And it's like, idolatry is when you invest your power in something secular. And there's no return on that power. It only takes. It does not give. I was like, you mean like alcohol? You know, pay a high price for low living? You mean like crack? Pay a high price for low living? It takes, takes, takes. Everything gives you nothing in return but a brief morsel of bliss. And eventually not even that, you know. Idolatry, the only place man can invest that power and get a return is God. There's one who has all power. That one is God. May you find him now. We have a program that allows that power to come in. And what we put into it, we get far more out of it. A great investment. We talk about life ain't fair. We're giving you a deal that's better than fair. A way of life that gets infinitely more wonderful as time passes. That's what we have here, you know. Or you can go on with your way of death. You know, first step really boils down to this. I'm killing myself and I don't know how to live. You know, be it with drugs or sex or gambling or food or alcohol or crack or meth. You're killing yourself and you know it. Deep down inside, you know it. My last night out, but towards the end, I'm saying to myself, this shit is killing me. And then I do another line. For 6 hours, I said that. And do another line. You know? And I'm killing myself. All I knew how to do at that point was die. I didn't know how to live. That's what it means by our life's unmanageable. We don't know how to live. you know. So you can keep on doing your way of death, and it don't mean you're doing the drugs. See, it tells us that we came to believe in the hopelessness and futility of life as we have been living it. Life as we've been living it. Everything I was doing was killing me. It supported my addiction. So I had to have a new way of life. I remember being in treatment, and I checked in. Okay, job wasn't on me. I was about to lose it. I just didn't know. Girlfriend ain't on me. What I felt was if you take every day I did cocaine, you may have 4 or 5 months. But I drank for 18 years and smoked weed for 18 years. And there at the end, I wasn't smoking weed and I wasn't drinking. I love to drink. But this took me over. And I had a sense of control when I drank. I had an in-control feeling when I drank. I had a sense of control when I smoked weed. I had an in-control feeling. When I did cocaine, it was totally out of control. You know, and I spent 16 hours doing cocaine, and at the end I felt with every line my soul was leaving me. I could feel that. It was this ring, and I could, there go a piece of my soul, there go a piece of my soul, there go a piece of my soul. And I went in the bathroom, and I've been on this week-long binge. I don't even know if I drank water. I know I didn't eat food. And I saw my reflection in the mirror, and I thought somebody broke in. I jumped back to fight, and he assumed a stance, too. Then I said, wait. It was me. And I didn't recognize me, and I hit my knees. God help me, because I can't. Steps 1, 2, and 3 right there. See, that's when we took this step. All sorts of remarkable things followed. Here's a remarkable thing. The police came to my house. But fortunately, my brother-in-law had took me out to convince me to go back to smoking weed and drinking beer and leaving the cocaine alone. And while we're sitting there, we're having this conversation, here come 5 police cars this way, 5 this way. I'm like, man, I don't know who they're after, but somebody's donut break got interrupted, and they're going to kick some butt. And they pulled up to us. And my brother-in-law said, don't worry, I'll handle this. And I'm like, go ahead. Because as soon as they start beating you up, I'm going over this fence back here, you know. But the first cop out of the car was the only one I knew on the Lawrence Police Department. Which I don't know about Lawrence Police Department was they shoot first, ask questions later. Or they shoot first, second, third, fourth, fifth, ask questions later. Only one I knew on that force was Scott. I said, Scott, what's up? He's like, Jerry, is that you? I said, yeah, man, what's going on? He's like, don't worry about it. I'll take care of it. And they went away. That's my last night out there, you know. So, you know, I did 1, 2, and 3 there. Remarkable things followed. I ended up going to a psychiatric hospital. And something remarkable happened there. I told the truth. That was not my plan. I'm like sitting up with this lie in my head. My mouth start moving, and words sound like a foreign language. You know, like, who's talking? Who's talking here? Don't tell them we sell drugs. This is the DEA. No, you don't say that. You know, and I just sat back, and my mouth is running on autopilot, telling everything. It's not what my mind is thinking. And the lady said, "Well, you need inpatient treatment." I'm like, "Okay, when?" And she's like, well, right now. I said, no, I can't be here now. Why? It's Friday. I got to go make up this money. I done messed up, you know. And she said, I said, I'll be back Monday. She said, you leave here today, you'll be dead. And the way that translated in my sick mind was, the DEA is not interested in arresting me. They're going to kill me. If I walk out that door, there'll be a red dot in my chest. Pow! It'll be game over. And that's why I stayed there, you know. But, you know, this new way of life that guy up front, so I'm in this treatment center. It's the second one because that first one, you know, God, Isaac talked about this, being afraid to commit suicide because you would screw it up and end up a paraplegic, you know. And I had that, but I also had a fear of asking for help, too. You know, I almost drowned 3 times, never asked for help, you know. And that was the first time I did it in my life, and I screwed it up, you know. So the second treatment center I went to, they called me and said, "You're at the wrong place." You know, I said, "Well, I want to stay here." They said, "Oh, we're not saying you can't stay there. You just have to pay for it." "How much is it?" They're like, "It's $800 a day." So we only paid $3. You know, I killed a lot of brain cells, but the math brain cell was still working, okay? I was like, "Man, okay, all right, I'll go where you want me to go." So I checked into their treatment center, and on one of the first meetings I went to, guy said, "Anyone interested in a new way of life?" My thought right before that was, "My life is screwed up. I need a new life." Boom. "Anyone interested in a new way of life?" "Yeah. Me. He's like, "Give that man a newcomer token." I call them loser tokens. Only loser took them things. I'm not taking one. But he gave it to me, and I said, "Well, you are sort of a loser." Sort of, right? Like I was on a winning streak. And he took me up after me and said, "This is how we live." I said, "Okay, that makes sense," because they were taught working the steps, and I only work if you pay me. You know, so when he said, "This is how we live," yeah, I was interested. So that's how I started out. I started out in AA. You know, CA hadn't started in Indy when I got sober, or it had just started. I thought it was just some crackhead scheming on the money in the basket, you know. So after a year sober, I ended up in CA, where a bunch of addicts trying to get 30 days, and I walk in with a year, right? They're like, "An old-timer." "Oh, what do you mean?" I mean, I've been hanging out with guys 15, 20, 25 years, you know, in AA, and they talk about I'm an old-timer. I went back to my sponsor, "Hey, Keith, man, they're talking about I'm an old-timer." He's like, "Well, how much time they got, Jerry?" I said, "About 30 days. "Well, you are an old-timer to them. You know, you just go there and give them what you got, you know." Okay, so I start going there, and I remember when I became secretary of the group last straw meeting, about 200 addicts there. And the secretary here went out with the money. Imagine that. You know, just what I said. So they start passing the stuff around. I'm not really paying attention. It comes to me, I pass it, they pass it back. I'm like, "What is this?" They said, "We think you're the only one of us who can handle money." Oh, so the group conscious was, I was a secretary. And that started my service work career. I spent the next 19 years in service to CA on the group level. I started a lot of meetings, you know. What do you say? You need a resentment and a coffee pot? Yeah. Angry man. I'll go to Goodwill and get a coffee pot. Bought a lot of coffee pots, you know. And then we started the district. It was 11 of us, and we really wanted it to be 12. But we couldn't keep one member, so we kept going back out. And we grew the district, and then, you know, we did the inventory on the tokens that first year. And we found out we had given away 1,500 newcomer tokens. We were thrilled. So then we look at the 30-day tokens. Well, only gave out 300 of those. Look at the 60-day tokens. Only a couple hundred of those. 90-day tokens. Only 100 of those. By the time we got the one-year tokens, like 10. 10 out of 1,500 is less than the law of averages, okay? You know? But we were giving them what we had. And I remember when we did the first workshop in CA. I don't know why they did a plaque, you know, but they put a plaque in this recovery house. It still sit up there, first CA workshop, you know. But it started out with 36 guys, ended with 6. But of the 6, 5 are still sober today, you know. So I'm not down on the fellowship, but it is not the answer. It's a wonderful, wonderful thing. This is where I learned love, you know. They love me till I can love myself. It's where my sponsor showed me love is an action. It's where I found my sponsor. It's where I found the guys that took me through the steps, you know, four-step Keith. He was one-trick pony. I'm like, you do know there are other steps. He's like, yeah, we're going to get to the ninth step. Don't worry. So the answer is in that big blue book with no pictures. My home group, the Fourth Dimension group, with a big book step study meeting. And we get a lot into AA history. You ought to read what Bill said initially with how it works. You shall, you must, on your knees, we doubt if you can. I call it the you version of how it works. Because like I see Bill pointing his finger at him, you know. But it also says something in there about the up in the forward of those who came to AA and really tried, 50% got sober at once. You know, really tried what? The steps. See, they couldn't do 90 meetings in 90 days. You come to AA, boom, you go through the steps right away. They took you through the steps before they took you to a meeting. They had a tremendous success rate. Cleveland AAs sobered up 400 drunks in 1 year with only 16 relapses. Oh, if we could only do that today, you know. And my sponsor, who I have now, Big Book Bob, showed me this. And I changed the way I sponsored. This is not how I was sponsored, but I changed into a step sponsor, meaning I would take you through the steps. And that is the greatest act of love that I can show you. I'm going to save your life. Let me rephrase that. I'm going to put you in touch with a power that will save your life. You know, and it's up to you to interact with that power, to stay sober, and to improve the quality of your life. So, you know, we emphasize that the fellowship is not the solution, nor is the allergy the problem. If I go out here and drink, man, it's just like 27 years ago. I still have the allergy. I go out here and do some cocaine, it's all night. I still have that allergy. I don't have the obsession of the mind. The problem of the cocaine addict, the heroin addict, the gambling addict, the sex addict, the food addict, the meth addict, centers in the mind, not the body, not in the pipe, not in the needle, not on the plate, not at the track. It's in the mind, you know. And the only thing that solves that is a psychic change. I learned a word, a Greek word, metanoia. You know, what does that mean? Repent. What does that mean? New mind, you know. So in essence, when we do the 12 steps, we repent and we develop a new mind. See, I'm not, a lot of my sponsees, I tell them about the sociopath things and my past history. They're like, no, you ain't. You couldn't possibly have been like that. I was like, trust me. I miss my old timers who could tell them what I was like when I came in. I was, no offense, Bryce, but I told Susan, I said, you know, I look at Bryce and I think arrogant prick. Because that's what you said about me all the time, arrogant prick. I got a boss at work, freaking narcissist. My therapist said, how do you a narcissist? I said, oh, trust me, I've been there. I said, I'm a recovering narcissist. You know, I said, but I know it, so a lot of times I just shut up. Don't say a word. Let the thoughts roll on through my mind. Everything I think is not fit for human consumption. It's just meant to be thought. So, you know, this program has afforded me a way of life that has purpose and promise. You know, I sponsored over 200 people. Now, the first 100 I did, like the friend and the life coach, with absolutely no skill for that, right? So six of them say sober. You know, the second 100, over half of them stayed sober when I just put them through the steps. So that's what works for me. That's where I'm effective. That's pretty much my reputation. So when you come to me for help, we're not talking about step one and step two. We're talking about the third step, commitment. I used to scare a lot of guys off in CA when I say that third step commitment. I mean, when you look at the third step prayer, it says, may I do thy will always. I know what that is. That's a commitment, you know. So that's what it is, a commitment to do God's will, not mine. And that's not an easy thing to do. See, I got these instincts for things. I want things, you know, especially if it's somebody else's. I had a friend down there. She was married and divorced like 6 times. She said, I just got this thing for playing with other people's toys. I thought, yeah, me too, you know. So what I have to do is when I get there, I have to pray. There's nothing that can come into my life that I can't answer with prayer. You know, we're going to talk about that 7-step prayer after this. And I tell people all the time when they say, I'm powerless over people, places, and things. I'm like, okay, could it be that you're dealing with people God didn't intend for you to deal with? Could it be you're going places God didn't intend for you to go? Could it be you're doing things God didn't intend for you to do? Because it says there, grant me strength as I go out from here to do your bidding. What is strength? Power. You know, I'm still at my job because God wants me there. Trust me. Well, a lot of times they should have fired me. There were times the papers were drawn up, and I just made the amends at just the right time. But no, one time they told me that I've been late so much that if I was late one more time or missed the day, I was fired. They said, you have to do perfect attendance. I said, okay. They're like, you can't be late either. Okay. And the next day, I'm on my way to work, and they dropped the barrier over this bridge on the road I travel. I'm like, oh, my God, I'm fired. I said, but I told God I'd do my best, so I just went on around, and every light went my way. Halfway to work, I said, oh, God, I see what you're doing. I'm going to get there just in time. And I said, big deal is 86th Street because nobody gets across 86th Street without stopping. Sailed right through it, went to the parking lot. I was going to run up the stairs. I said, I'm taking the elevator. Elevator's never there, right? So I hit it, boom, it's there. Go up, grab my time card, clock in, it goes, I just in time. This is where God want me, right? And I've been having problems recently where I thought about retiring. I'm at that age, I could pull the trigger. God wants me there. You know, God wants me there. I don't know why. But, you know, this purpose is helping others. And it says, when anyone anywhere reaches out, I want the hand of AACA, Al-Anon, whatever, to be there. One time this hand reached out, and he had hate on one knuckles and love on the other. I'm like, what's up with the love? He said, I love to hate people. And dude had a shaved head, long ZZ top beard. I'm like, redneck, man. And he want to talk to me, and I'm like, okay, God, I'll talk to him, but he better not ask me for my phone number. Just as I had that thought, he said, can I have your phone number? I was like, yeah, sure, why not? Call me anytime, you know. And I said, you better not call me, God, you know, and we keep talking for about an hour. So he doesn't call me, thank God. And the next couple of weeks, I see him again, but I don't know it's him because now he shaved the beard and grew hair on his head. So I was talking to somebody. He said, well, what do you say to these sponsors? I said, you say hello. Haven't you ever used a phone before? And he stopped talking. I said, you seem to know a lot about me. He said, we talked out on the street for about an hour, 2 weeks ago. Oh, it's you. So I ended up being his sponsor. We did a workshop over his house and took him through the steps, and it came time for his 5th step. And he told me it murdered 9 people. This is my face. I'm sitting here with a mass murderer. He don't like black people either. He told me that day. He said, well, you just sat there calm when I told you that. That scared the hell out of me. And so, you know, we got through his 5th step, and after that you do an hour. And I said, now you go back here, you meditate on an hour, say these prayers, blah, 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 blah. I said, matter of fact, you take 2 hours and then call me. He said, why you want me to call me? In case I want a drink? I said, yeah, because I'm thinking if this don't work, I'm leaving town, you know. And he called me and talked about this piece he had, you know. And later on, we're talking about the amends. And he asked me, how do I make amends for those murders? And my mind is, turn yourself in. I just feel much more comfortable with a guy like you behind bars, you know. I said, I don't know, man. I said, I only thought about killing people. You're a doer. You're a man of action. Big book say we pray and we ask God, you know, so pray on it. And he called me up a couple of weeks later. He said, that's the strangest day. I said, really, what happened? He said, this guy called me, was going to kill himself. I said, what'd you do? He said, I talked him out of it, and then I went over his house and hooked him up with Midtown Mental Health, some free mental health. I said, yeah, you know all about that, because dude had problems, right? And I said, okay. He said, and when I was leaving, I asked him, what meeting did I give you my phone number in? He's like, meeting? What are you talking about? He said, AA. What AA meeting did I give you my phone number? He said, what's AA? What are you talking about? It's the wrong number. And I said, no, I don't think that was the wrong number. I think God's forgiven you. And that's Randy. Randy went on to be my best friend. My best friend. And one time he got off his meds because somebody told him he wasn't sober because he was taking them, not knowing crap about him. And his wife calls me in a frantic, talking about he's going to kill us all. And I'm going down there like, my God, did he get rid of that sawed-off shotgun? You know, God, why'd you put this crazy SOB in my life? Is this how I'm supposed to die? You know? And Randy, the nine murders, he's in the Outlaws. You know, that's blood in, blood out. He's so bad that he left, and they're like, I'm not going to touch that, you know. He walked away. They're supposed to kill him. They ain't touching it. So I go down there. His wife runs out of the minivan, says he's in there, dark house, right? Common sense say, call SWAT, send them there. But I'm like, that's my guy. That's my guy. And I go in, and he's over in the corner in his long coat. I said, the killing coat. I know what's under that coat. I said, why you got that coat on, man? He said, I want it on. I said, you actually look pretty good in it, so keep it on. But why are you in the dark? And then he told me he read his wife's fourth step. And I snapped and went off on him while he's got the gun. But we talked, and I said, can I tell your family it's cool? Can I tell your little princess it's cool to come back home? He's like, yeah. You know, so I told him it was okay. Police didn't get involved, and stayed over there for 2-3 hours talking to him. And he gave me As Bill Sees It book, and that's when I knew he was okay. And I left, and I said, Randy, I said, man, you got to take your meds the way your psychiatrist tell you to take them. Don't listen to these AA jackleg doctors in the room. They don't know what's going on with you. And you know, I said, you okay now? He's like, yeah. I said, well, I'm just glad I was able to say something to help you out. He said, oh, nothing you said helped. What? I talked to you for like 3 hours, man. I gave you my best stuff. What do you mean nothing helped? He said, I was okay when you walked through the doors. You seemed to need to talk. So I listened. Wow. Wow. So Randy died 4 years sober, and at his funeral, Sue sent some flowers down, and it had to be like 50 guys came up to me and said, he saved my life. You know, and I was like, God, cunning, baffling, powerful, you know. Because I'd have never thought that. How do you make amends for those murders? I never crossed my mind. We'll go out and save some lives. I'm like, lock your ass up. Throw away the key. You know, give them family some peace, whatever. God had a different plan. And that's when I got rid of forever the I'm going to get you God. God of justice. Just a God of love. You know, I say that the difference between religion and spirituality is that religion is based on the fear of God and spirituality is based on the love of God. And all I've ever got from God was love. It was not what my mother told me. You know, this pisses some people off for various reasons, but I always say that if I pissed you off, God sent me here to bring up some darkness in you for you to address, so you should thank me. No. See what I mean, arrogant prick? You know? No, but it's a play on John 3:16. God so loved the addict and alcoholic that he gave unto them the 12 steps. And those who live by them shall not perish, but live happy, joyous, and free now and throughout all of eternity. My name's Jerry. I'm an alcoholic and an addict. Thank you.
Thank you.